Well, good morning. I want to welcome you to this conference, this seminar, Flourishing in Ministry. And my name is Dave Higgle. I'm with Education and Clergy Development and work a lot with clergy care. And thank you so much for coming to this seminar. I want to introduce you to our speaker, Dr. Chris Adams. Chris is the executive director of the Center for Vocational Ministry at Azusa Pacific University, and is a clinical psychologist there, and does a lot of work with clergy research on clergy well-being. And Chris has just become a really good friend of ours over the last couple of years, both personally and professionally, working with our department, and we're working on different initiatives together. And he does a lot of work with clergy assessment and working with different district boards of ordination and this kind of thing. There's a lot that I could share about Chris, but he is involved also with the Duke Health Initiative. I can never remember quite the name of that.
Clergy Health Initiative.
Clergy Health Initiative through Duke that some of you might be aware of, and also is kind of one of the partner researchers with Dr. Matthew Bloom at Notre Dame University for the Flourishing in Ministry study that they are doing with clergy everywhere in a variety of denominations. It's a longitudinal study that Chris may tell you is going to tell us a little bit more about. About 4 years ago, some of you participated, if not all of you participated, in a survey that a partnership that we have with that study with Matt Bloom, and Chris is one of the interpreters of the research. And so 4 years ago, we had our first survey through the Flourishing in Ministry study and revealed a lot of really interesting and very helpful information and data, scientific data, that helped us as a division of Education and Clergy Development to know where to target our resources and what are the needs of our pastors. We didn't have, prior to this partnership, we did not have any data at all on the well-being of Wesleyan clergy. And in 2014, we got our first set of data on that. This fall, we took, and many of you participated in the survey, again, the Flourishing Ministry survey, so the second wave of that 4 years later. And that information has now come in. The data has now come in. And Chris is here today to help to interpret that data on the well-being of our Wesleyan pastors. And I had the opportunity to, Chris shared with me prior, a lot of what he's going to present today. And it's not just the data on the well-being of clergy, but a lot of other really helpful information that's research-based. And we don't want to just be shooting in the dark or guessing about what pastors need. But through this data, we want our initiatives to be the result of what the data is telling us and what you are telling us as a denomination and as pastors in our denomination. So, Chris, I'm so thankful that you're here. And I don't want to take any more time because of the nature of what he has to present today. There's a lot of good information here. We want to maximize our time together. And also, hopefully, we'll have some time for some questions and answers at the end. But I'm sure you'll find it very enlightening. I'd like to just have a quick word of prayer, if we could, before we begin. Father, thank you for the opportunity to be here and to partner with our friend Chris here, Dr. Adams. And we would ask, Lord, that you would just open up our minds and our hearts to deeper understanding of what is needed in the lives of our clergy. So we just thank you for the resources that have been made available to us through Chris and his team and the gifts that you have given to him that we are now beneficiaries of. So thank you in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen. Chris. Thank you so much, David. It is a joy and privilege to be with you this morning, and to partner with Russ and David over these last several years really has been an incredible joy. And you need to know, I have the opportunity to partner with a lot of different denominations, and what your denomination is doing for clergy care is truly on the cutting edge. It really is. There are more resources. If you haven't stopped by the booth, I'll reference this a little bit later, and picked up the list of stuff that they've designed and made available to you, you need to do that because it is more in volume and quality than most of the groups that I have the chance to work with. And so it really is great to be here, even the fact that you have this conference that's positively focused on the well-being of clergy is just really exciting. I flew in last night from Los Angeles area, so I'm on West Coast time this morning. So I'll do my best to keep myself awake and you as well. And it's great to be here with friends. Want to introduce a couple of folks real quick. In the back, Joe, if you'd raise your hand there, one of my colleagues and staff at the Center for Vocational Ministry, Joe Halbert, is here with me as well. And we'll be milling about after we're done here. Would love to connect with you and know who you are and how we can support you in ministry. Dave Johnson is here, who's pastor right down the street from APU and district superintendent on the, what's it called? Assistant district superintendent, sorry. I just promoted you. How about that? And alum of our seminary, so it's great to be here, Dave, with you too. And I want to jump in here and share with you from the Flourishing in Ministry Research Project. We're almost 10 years into the project, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 clergy are participating. I'm just curious if any of you participated in the most recent iteration of filling out a survey, getting the feedback tool. The phone app is also now available, so from the website you can also download the Daily Wellbeing phone app, so I encourage you to do that. I'll have instructions at the end for those of you that haven't had a chance yet to participate. It's all funded by Lilly, so God bless Lilly. I understand you heard from Russ about the financial initiative that you have going on, too, that's also Lilly-funded. So it's free to you, and it's an interactive portal where you can get personalized feedback about your well-being and ministry and these research-informed categories I'm going to share with you, along with some best practices that research suggests you can engage in, really as a rule of life, as a rhythm to your own self-care to help boost your own well-being in these areas. And so we'll talk about some of those strategies as we go through this as well. I'm a pastor's kid of a pastor's kid. Any PKs here? I was like asking this. Okay. Support group right here. We'll talk. My grandfather was a Nazarene pastor, as is my dad, and I have a number of years in pastoral ministry myself before becoming a psychologist specializing in working with clergy, and really just find it a privilege and a joy to share with groups of pastors. How many of you have pastor's kids? Yeah? Okay. So I just got to tell this quick story. We started a pastor's kid fellowship at APU a number of years ago. We have a lot of PKs running around like I'm sure they do at Indiana Wesleyan, other Christian colleges. And we had a group of them together. We actually showed a Michael Jr. video at this event, so it was fun to see him live last night. That was a blast. And we got done. I dismissed them. It was about 100 students. And without me asking them, they all started to put chairs away, which college students wouldn't normally do unless they're a pastor's kid, unless you ask them. So then I pointed that out, and we all laughed about that. But it was just like second nature, right? First ones to church, last ones to leave, and all that kind of stuff. Well, we know from existing research, some of the difficulties that pastors face. And some of them are common to helping professions in general, but there is no other role like being a pastor. There's no other more joyful role, I would contend, but it also has unique and hidden stresses that sometimes are not even noticed by pastors themselves, in my experience. And so I hope to tease some of that out. In 1998, Martin Seligman, the president at that time of the American Psychological Association, gave a keynote address. This was 20 years ago. And he said, psychology for decades now has studied what's wrong with people. And that's important to know because then we can diagnose and know how to treat and help people improve, eliminate suffering, improve their life. But it's high time that we started studying what's right with healthy people. What a concept, huh? And that gave birth to a movement in the social sciences known as positive psychology. And the Flourishing in Ministry study is taking the state of the art of positive psychology, studying human flourishing, which is a global body of research now, and specifically tailoring that to clergy in particular, looking at well-being at work, in helping professions generally, but specifically with pastors, so we can learn not just what prevents the difficulty, but what promotes health and flourishing. You need both. Preventing difficulty and suffering and depression, burnout, anxiety, that's part of the equation, but that doesn't get us all the way to flourishing. We also need to think about the things that promote health to get all the way to flourishing. Make sense? We also know that uniquely, and it's true for all people, but uniquely for pastors, well-being happens in an ecosystem. You have a very unique role in an ecological system. If you think of yourself in the center of a target, and then the next ring out would be your immediate marriage and family if you're married, and if you're not, your immediate closest family and friends. And then out from there, maybe another circle of close friends, and then your congregation, and then your denomination, and your community, etc. There are joys and stresses at each level of that target. And those stresses interact with each other in complex ways at various levels. And there just is no other role like being a pastor. Amen? It's a very unique social role. And there are powerful implications to that, but there also are some challenging ones that we want to talk about a little bit. We know that daily well-being accumulates. You might think about the really amazing Sunday that maybe is in your recent memory, when God just seemed to really bless a worship service. The worship team was just on their A game that morning. You preached the sermon that it didn't matter what anybody told you about the sermon afterward, because you knew that you preached the word that the Lord gave you to preach. Amen? And there's just no other feeling quite like that. And there tends to be an after effect about that. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, where God lives, I like to say. It is, in fact, in Nashville, Tennessee, in the middle of the Bible Belt. And after church on Sunday night, we went to church like four times a day on Sunday back in those days, it seemed like, but loved it. In the youth group, we would have what we call the afterglow. Anybody know that term? I think it was sort of like the Shekinah glory of God, you know, you experienced in church, and then you'd bask in the afterglow or something was the idea. So we'd have the afterglow. Well, there's something like that happening we're finding with pastors. After that really amazing day in ministry, the joy of that, sort of the euphoria, really basking in, just all the wonderful feelings about that, lasts for two or three days. Tuesday, maybe into Wednesday, you're still sort of basking in the joy of that. Unfortunately, the same is also true of the really difficult day in ministry. The day when there's a tough board meeting or multiple crises. Why do they always come in clusters, by the way? I wish they came one at a time and somebody consulted our calendar before they all come in clusters. But the tough days in ministry, we're finding, actually have a longer afterglow. The impact of those tough days lasts 5 or 6 days. And so the implication of that is, what are you thinking about in terms of your own rhythms and self-care? What if you have several of those bad days in a row? What are you doing to help yourself recover from those? What are you doing to give yourself a buffer to cope with those days? Which will come for every pastor. It just comes with life and comes with the job. Amen? One of the things that the Daily app is designed to do, if you download it, is to take you through a process called Map My Days. And it asks you randomly a couple questions a day about your well-being in a particular area. And over time, it will show you sort of a dashboard type of thing. And you can look back and see, oh, I had three rough days in a row. Let me go back and look at my calendar. What was happening on those days? What are some things I might be able to do? Even small incremental changes to switch up my rhythm just a little bit to help boost my well-being when I'm facing some stressful days. So we'll get into that a little bit too. All right. After hundreds and hundreds of in-depth interviews and thousands and thousands of pastors helping us refine our survey tool that you can fill out online, this is the core model. And by the way, I meant to mention, we will email slides to folks, right, David? We have a way of doing that. Do we need a sign-up sheet, or we know who's in the room somehow?
We would probably need to collect those. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have a mechanism to collect those here.
I'll give my email at the end, and you can email me if you'd like a PDF copy of the slides, which I'm happy to send to you. Or if somebody has a sheet of paper and can pass that around, that might be the easiest thing. Joe, do you have a piece of paper by any chance? Thanks. And jot down your email address, and I'll send them to you on the plane on the way home, PDF of these slides. This is the flourishing, what we think is the core model of flourishing in ministry for pastors. We're going to go through each one of these dimensions. The two on the bottom, thriving and self-integrity or authenticity is probably a better word we'll start using, are on the bottom because they're foundational. Everyday happiness and resilience are at the top. Everyday happiness is the first thing to decline for pastors. Just that sense of everyday well-being. And if it gets low enough, it starts to pull down the other three. And so we're going to talk quite a bit about that one. The circle in the middle is meant to convey a cycle such that the more we experience everyday happiness, the more resilience we have, which leads to more thriving, which leads to more authenticity, which leads to even more everyday well-being, which leads to more resilience and so forth. The term in the well-being research is broaden and build. It's really like a spiral staircase that gets broader and broader. And so you can put yourself into a positive spiral of flourishing. You know anybody in your church in a negative spiral? My grandfather, in his church, he had a woman in his church, he used to say that enjoyed poor health. You know anybody like that in your church? That just, for mysterious reasons, seems to be really invested in perpetually being in crisis all the time when they really don't have to be and just enjoy the downward spiral. Well, there's a version of that for pastors that we have to be careful about. In fact, at a gathering like this, and it's wonderful to gather together like this with other pastors, we'll talk more about that in a minute. One of the dangers, though, if you were to walk around after, in between sessions, around the coffee shop or whatever, is that we can get together an event like this and start one-upping each other's misery in ministry. You ever heard that happen with pastors? As if there's some sort of award or something, you know, some sort of badge. We can get into sort of a self-imposed martyrdom kind of a place if we're not careful. And so what we want to talk about is interrupting that. Certainly there is sacrifice in ministry, and just by being a disciple of Christ, no question, that is certainly the case. But apparently it's possible to experience suffering, but also joy at the same time. And how do we help ourselves experience joy and flourishing over the long haul? Okay. I want to start, we're going to start in a strength-based way. So what I'm going to do is share the general findings from the overall study that include all the pastors that we've looked at, and then the Wesleyan specific results to give you some context, and then you can think about yourself in that context. So we're going to start with thriving there at the bottom. This really has to do with connection. Connection to other people, connection to meaning and purpose in life, and connection to transcendence is the way the generic literature talks about it, but connection to God. Feeling connected to God on a regular basis. In fact, what we're finding is that pastors who look at ministry as participating with what God is already doing in the world tend to flourish more. As opposed to, nothing's really going on, God's not really present, until I show up with my bag of tricks, and then the kingdom of God can come. Which is a philosophy of ministry that you may see out there, right? That's a very different theology of ministry. It's also very different psychologically. Because if it's all up to me, if it's all riding on me, then I have to have an enormous amount of pressure on me to produce results. That's stressful. But if I can focus on the process of being with God and allow God to accomplish the results, that's a very different place to be. Make sense? So this is where we talk about looking at that connectedness to really counteract, isolation, which perhaps is the biggest occupational hazard of ministry. And it's paradoxical. It's sort of a water everywhere and not a drop to drink kind of a phenomenon, because you're around people all the time. In fact, people are often baffled if they've never been a pastor. How could pastors possibly be lonely and isolated? But it's an inherently socially and psychologically isolating role. It just is, for a variety of complex reasons. And if we don't proactively counteract that isolation, then that can lead to some difficulty. And pastors that get too isolated end up going down roads that can be really problematic and destructive. So how are Wesleyan pastors doing in this thriving quadrant? You're actually doing quite well. Congratulations. It's not true of every denomination that I speak to. And I'll let you kind of think about and discuss amongst yourselves why do you think this is the case. But you're feeling a lot of connection to one another. You're feeling a lot of support from really every level of that ecosystem, including your denominational leadership, which I assure you is not always the case in every denomination that I speak to. You feel a sense of connection to your spouse, your clergy peers, your non-clergy peers, your congregation. Just overall, there's a lot of feeling of connectedness and support to other people in all the right ways, connection to God, connection to meaning. Interestingly, overall, by the way, female pastors tend to be flourishing a bit more, among at least among the sample. It's about 700 or so Wesleyan pastors in this particular sample. Don't know for sure why. I've got some hunches about that, but those of ladies in the room, I think the gentlemen in the room could learn something from you. Keep doing what you're doing because you seem to be flourishing a bit more than the male pastors. Female pastors have a deeper sense of meaning in life and ministry, and faith gives more meaning to life. Could be because, again, we have to be careful with gender stereotypes, but women sometimes naturally connect better. They're more relational by nature, depending on the person. And so that can apply both to other people and to God and to meaning and purpose in life. So you're doing really well in this area. Keep doing what you're doing. I suspect it has something to do with being intentional about relationships. And I want to give you a metaphor for the kinds of relationships pastors need to thrive in ministry. You see a picture of a stage here. If you know anything about acting, I don't know much. I know I like watching good acting. But when we watch a movie or a play and it's an incredible performance and an incredible actor, there's something authentic in the actor themselves that has continuity and is expressed as they fulfill a particular kind of role on the front stage. And in a sense, you are fulfilling a role, and you need three kinds of relationships. You need front stage relationships, you need backstage relationships, and you need offstage relationships. Have to have an offstage. Front stage, those folks that share ministry with you. They're allies in ministry. They may not be personal confidants necessarily, but they're with you. They're on board with the mission of the church. They're on board with who you are and your leadership. They're supportive of you, and they can relate to you to some extent as a person, not just as your role. That's why it's isolating. It's because people are primarily relating to our role more than who we are as a person. And you model appropriate vulnerability and transparency as opposed to inappropriate vulnerability. I don't know if you've ever sat and listened to a sermon where you felt like you need to take a shower afterward because it was TMI, you know, somebody's working through their emotional issues on you while you're sitting in the pew. Not talking about that, but that appropriate level of transparency and vulnerability, which demonstrates health and in relationship to God and others, and says to people, you know, I'm not all that unlike you, and I experience God in this particular way, and you can too. Backstage, what happens on the backstage? You can talk about the technical aspects of the front stage. There are all the other people that support people that make things happen in preparation. It's one of the things we talk with seminary students about. Sometimes people come to seminary because they had an amazing youth pastor, and their impression is that 100% of ministry is the front stage because they saw this really dynamic, charismatic pastor. How much of ministry is actually on the front stage as a pastor? Give me a percentage, anybody. Anybody have an estimate? 20%? 30% maybe? There's an awful lot that happens in preparation for Sunday morning, for example, that's backstage. An awful lot of time. A lot of ministry is backstage. And so we need other people that are sharing in that backstage with us. Other staff, denominational leaders, we're finding that mentoring is huge at every stage of a career, particularly the first 5 to 7 years as people are forming a pastoral identity. And then doing what you're doing here and at other kinds of gatherings like this is vitally important, having what we call a community of practice. Other people that do what you do. And this would apply to spouses as well. Other clergy spouses that you can connect with. You don't have to explain what it's like to be a Wesleyan pastor in 2019 or a Wesleyan pastor spouse. They just know. And it helps break that isolation of what that experience is like. And you can find mutual support and accountability and encouragement and share ideas and all those kinds of things. And so if you don't regularly participate in some sort of clergy peer group, I really want to highly encourage you to do that. Because over the long haul, what we're finding is it makes an enormous difference toward breaking that isolation and preventing burnout, those kinds of things. Then you have to have an offstage. One of my mentors, who's now in his 80s, is a man named Dr. Archibald Hart, who's one of the first people to really study ministry stress and burnout. And one of his many quotes I'm fond of stealing is that pastors don't get into difficulty because we forget that we're pastors. We get into difficulty because we forget that we're persons. You have to have somewhere to just be a person, to be a human being, to laugh, to play, to have true two-way intimacy when most of the relationships, if not all of them in your life, are one-way intimacy, to really show all of who you are, to be spontaneous, to vent if you're angry about something, even if it's towards somebody in your congregation that you love because you're called to, but you don't like them very much, if we're honest. Ever been there? Yeah. Where can you step out of the role for a little while and just be a person? Certainly family needs to be that if it's healthy, and you'll hear Pete and Jerry Scazzaro talk about that. And then having a close personal friendship, at least one, outside of your congregation or ministry context. They're not part of that relational system. They're outside of that. So they relate to you as Dave, not as Pastor Dave, for example. And you can just hang out and be yourself is really important. Okay. So that's thriving. Let's talk about authenticity or self-integrity. What we're finding in this research overall is that the key to long-term well-being for pastors is developing what we're calling a positive pastoral identity, which is to say a sense of myself that's authentic. It's my true self, not a false self. And if you're familiar with that distinction, it's throughout actually ancient Christian early fathers and mothers and Christian spirituality as well as some psychological theories. False self is the self that I develop, the person I think I'm supposed to be to gain or keep approval or love, as opposed to who I really am, which is hidden in God with Christ, and allowing God to lead me into that full experience of who God really created me to be and letting that express itself in my pastoral role. The pastors that are able to do that tend to flourish more. And sustain that identity over time in the face of all the challenges and threats to that sense of the pastoral identity. One of my grandmothers used to say that you should choose your rut carefully because you'll be in it for a long time. You ever heard that phrase before? A reference to the wagon trains that used to come from the East Coast to the West Coast of the United States, and wagon after wagon would follow one another, and before long there were ruts in the ground. And you could put the wagon wheels in those ruts on the East Coast, and you'd be in that track all the way out till you got out to California, I suppose. And something like that seems to be the case we're finding in this research, that if pastors can get on a positive trajectory early, then that tends to be the case over the long haul. And if they don't, then it's not impossible to get into a positive trajectory, but it can tend to be a struggle. And mentoring is really huge in that. So if any of you work with clergy who are just starting out, have young people on your staff, it's just vitally important. We think it takes 5 to 7 years or so to really form and crystallize that pastoral identity, even once you get out of seminary, because you need to experience yourself in the role for a while. The same thing's true of like physicians, psychologists. You don't feel like a doctor the minute you graduate from medical school. You have to practice medicine for some years till you really have a sense of, okay, I know what I'm doing. And the same thing is true for pastors. It takes time because it's such a complex role. So to have a sense of identity, clarity, and strength, and authentic engagement with ministry work is really vital. around these kinds of things. What are my capabilities, my strengths, my talents, my gifts, my personality characteristics? How did God uniquely wire me? And then what do I value the most? What are my deepest convictions? What do I care about the most among all the important things in church life and different aspects of the gospel? And what's the fit? We're finding that this is a bigger deal than we thought it was going to be when we first started out with this research. The fit between a person in a particular role in a particular context. Sometimes this isn't thought through well on the front end. There isn't good premarital counseling, as it were, between a pastor and a church. And a year or two into that relationship, we start to realize we're on very different pages. What the pastor cares most about, the church doesn't really care about. And if that initial gap is large, then that's going to be a difficult road. When we could have thought maybe through that fit a bit more. Pastors have a very complex role. There have been a couple well-done job analyses of clergy, which is what personnel psychologists do, where they analyze what are the tasks a person has to do on an hourly, daily, monthly, weekly basis, monthly basis, to do this job well. And then they analyze that and look at what are the areas of core competency a person would need in order to do this job. Everybody with me? And the folks that have done this for pastors, one of the researchers came back to us and said, I'm absolutely baffled. I have never seen a job this complex. Who would ever try this? This is a setup to feel inadequate. And I find that to be the case with pastors. Many of us carry around an invisible sack of shame and inadequacy because we expect ourselves and other people expect us to be an expert generalist. When the truth is, by nature, most of us are expert specialists. In other words, we're really great at maybe a third of the competencies needed to be a pastor. We're adequate in another third. And another third, we're not all that great in. And we know from positive psych research, you can spend all your time and energy trying to get better at that third that you're not very good at, and you'll get some incremental growth. But if you took that same time and energy and put that into developing your top strengths, you get exponential growth. And you leverage that growth to address the areas that aren't as developed, but also put people around you with complementary strengths and delegate. I want to give you permission to be yourself in ministry, to not have to be an expert. So this is our synthesis of all the key areas that you need to have competency in as a pastor. Of course, all of these categories break down into many subcategories. The categories in blue are what the Wesleyan pastors in the study said. That's what we spend most of our time doing. We spend most of our time in preaching and worship, teaching and spiritual formation, developing other people, leadership and management. The distinction there being leadership is organizational leadership. So vision, taking this whole organization from point A to point B. Management is the day in and day out of personnel, facilities, budget, etc. then following that, the non-italicized black font categories, fellowship, caregiving, denominational service, and self-development were the next bulk of time. And then the two italicized were the least amount of time, administering sacraments and communication evangelism. Don't know what you make of that. I just thought that might be interesting to you to see how our Wesleyan pastors spending their time. Is that how you should be spending your time? Don't know. That's for you to figure out, but you might find that interesting. So if we try to be something we're not for too long, pastors can start to second guess our sense of call. You know, did I really hear God correctly? Maybe it was what I had for dinner that night, and start to second guess that sense of calling. Most any pastor has done that at least once on a Monday, typically, right? So there's a certain amount of that that's normal. It just comes with, unfortunately, the job. But if that gets too intense too often, we can feel estranged from our call. So what can we do about this? Well, let me share with you first that you all are doing pretty well in this area. This is another area of strength. You're in a great range as we look at the optimal ranges of scores on these dimensions. You experience growth at work and experience work as a calling, authenticity, the goodness of fit is in a good range. So something's happening well denominationally that's promoting health in this area. And again, female pastors in the sample feel a stronger sense of authenticity in their work. We find this to be the case across the board and suspect that women are actually better than men in our culture at separating their sense of identity from their job. Men, we tend to define ourselves in a global sense from our work more than women do. And that makes it difficult to have a sense of identity just as a son of God, beloved, apart from my job. And women tend to be better at that. And so I wanted to share that with you. Some things we might want to think about, though, are that self-concept clarity and core self-evaluations are lower than the optimal range among Wesleyan pastors. This is also very frequent. People have a lot of expectations for you as a pastor. Have you noticed that? And they're what one author calls presumptive expectations, people presuming to know better than you do how you should do your job. And it's some people's spiritual gift to tell you that, like on Sunday, right? But often the most difficult expectations for pastors are the ones we have for ourselves. We have a high calling, and we take that seriously, and rightly so. We want to do right by this calling that God has placed on our lives. And so we can be very tough on ourselves, that we're not meeting up to this sort of self-ideal. There's a lot of interesting research coming out about a concept called self-compassion. How often, when you think of the pastoral care list that's on your mind and heart or in your planner, even as you're at this conference, many of you are calling back to somebody or praying for somebody or worried about somebody in your church because you know that they're going through something difficult or they just lost someone and they're grieving or whatever. Do you put yourself on that list? When is the last time that you extended to yourself the same kind of care and gentleness and compassion and kindness that you give to everybody else in your church? We often forget to do that. Put yourself on your own pastoral care list. Can I invite you to do that this morning? And then another thing that came up in your results, which is also not uncommon, is that special focus may be needed for bivocational and part-time pastors. From a research perspective, we're still sorting this out. Are there some benefits to being bivocational, perhaps? Because sometimes financially there are benefits, depending on what the other job is. It's a break from ministry work in some ways, depending on what the other job is. On the other hand, you don't have all of your time to give to ministry, so your time is divided, so maybe it cuts both ways, and we're still trying to figure that out. But some sort of focus on bivocational and part-time pastors, which seems to be a massive trend in North America anyway, that, you know, eventually it may be more the norm than the exception to be bivocational in the era in which we live. And so we want to keep looking at that. So stay tuned for more research about that. So what can we do about this? I want to encourage you to cultivate self-acceptance, which I think is closer to a biblical understanding of humility than maybe the way that we think about humility a lot. It's accepting myself with my gifts and strengths and feeling good about those. Pride is not feeling good about my strengths. Pride is an inaccurate self-appraisal that's inflated. But if it's accurate, then I don't think that's prideful. It's okay to feel good about your gifts and to lean into those. But also to accept your vulnerabilities, your weaknesses, your faults, and to have a place where you can talk about both of those and be a person. Do some job crafting, clarifying your role around your strengths. At least 60% of the time, it seems to be the threshold. If it dips too far below that for too long, people tend to disengage from their work, burn out more quickly. And of course, there are those days, maybe even those weeks, when most of your time you're spending outside of your sweet spots. Talked to my college roommate recently, who's a Nazarene pastor in Michigan. He said, "How's it going?" He said, "Well, okay, but yesterday the plumbing in the women's bathroom at the church broke and it started to flood. and nobody else is around except for me that day. So I YouTubed how to fix the plumbing. I don't even know anything about plumbing. Ran to the hardware store, got the tools, came back, and spent most of the day fixing the plumbing in the women's bathroom. Not the way I wanted to spend my day. Now I've got to find other time for sermon prep, and you know how that goes, right? That's the life of a pastor. And so there are those days, but even on those days, this is a very fascinating finding to me. If you can end the day on a high note, it makes an enormous difference over the long haul. To just spend at least 15 minutes at the end of your work day, whenever that happens, doing something that meets three criteria, that you love to do, that you're good at, it's one of your areas of mastery and strength and competency, and that really matters to the mission of your church or ministry. It's not tangential or peripheral, it's core to the mission. Spend at least 15 minutes doing that. It doesn't take away the bad day, but doing that as a regular practice every day, day in, day out, week in, week out, makes an enormous difference toward preventing burnout and promoting flourishing over the long haul. To return to the joy. What is it that brings you the most joy in ministry? What is it that you love to do in ministry? Do that at the end of the workday for at least 15 minutes. And it just gets us back in touch with that that piece of our work that we delight in the most. Develop financial literacy. The reason I put that here is because it just shows up again and again in the literature as a key competency. And it's not so much the lack of income, that's part of it, but it's more a sense of knowing what to do with whatever money I do have gives me a sense of efficacy in that area, which then reduces the stress associated with money psychologically. Does that make sense? And so it just so happens that you have a really incredible program and now $2 million, right, David, to address this. And I think Russ mentioned last night that he's mystified how difficult it's been to give away money to Wesleyan pastors. So take them up on their offer. And if you need some help in that area, and it can make an enormous difference to your overall sense of well-being just to have that financial piece solved. Yeah. Yeah. You're even giving out cash today, right? So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Make it rain. Okay. So we're continuing around the cycle here to everyday happiness or just everyday well-being. This is that sense of just generally having a good day, being in a good mood, that kind of thing. This is where we talk about stress and the most immediate impact of stress on our physical health, on our emotional health. How much of the time in any given day do you experience these kinds of things? Calm, peaceful, engaged, full of awe, joy, inspired. There are moments. That is, what about the overall tone? That's kind of what we're talking about here. Or how much of this is dominant? And again, there are these moments. I have a wonderful email from a pastor. If I had time, I would read it to you, where he talks about going to the hospital before Wednesday night church and then a board meeting. And he grieves with the family as they withdraw life support from a loved one. Literally 10 minutes later, walks down the hall in the same hospital and celebrates with a family who brings in a newborn baby into the world. I mean, you talk about a pendulum swing of emotions. If you're a human being, you're going to feel both ends of that and then not have time to process that because you've got to rush back to church. And he says, and meet with high-powered CEOs on the board who think you should run the church like a corporation, only to leave that and run to a homeless person in the parking lot who needs help for survival. And these extremes in the experience of ministry can be difficult. And if we don't process those well and have a place to take care of ourselves, then this can become dominant for us. So how do we sustain positivity? That's really what we're talking about here, so that we're a glass half full kind of person over time, as opposed to the glass half empty kind of person. my college roommate I mentioned earlier talks about his mother, that she's a glass half full kind of person, but the glass is just half full of something bad. So I guess there's a third option in there too. I want to talk briefly, and I got a long way to go, a short time to get there, about stress. One way to think about stress is it's just overextending our physiology. We were designed to respond to stress. There's a part of our brain that when we experience threat or stress, sends alert into our body, and all the resources in our body go to the most essential systems in the body, and resources are taken away from non-essential systems. The most quick, easy example of that is before you preach, if you're sort of psyching yourself up to preach and your hands get cold, because there's a certain stress to that, and your body's taking resources away from your extremities. That's why your hands and feet get cold when you're nervous or stressed or anxious. And that's designed to be short-lived. The threat comes, our system goes into stress response mode, the threat goes away, and then we return back to normal rest. But the difficulty in ministry is that the stresses and threats never go away. They're just constant. In a role that includes what we call role immersion. You're immersed in a role 24/7. When are you not a pastor? Did you punch out when you got on the plane to come here and you stopped being that? No. It is a 24/7, 365 role. There are wonderful things about that, but one of the implications about that is that there's a chronic elevated stress physiology in most pastors. When that happens, and it happens for long enough, we start to experience the cost of that. The natural painkillers, endorphins in the body are suppressed. We have more aches and pains. Anxiety disorders are now the number one reason that people go and see counselors and psychiatrists in America. It's surpassed depression. Probably the number one reason people come see you is somehow related to anxiety, because we're all living at a pace we're not designed to live in our culture. We're living at too fast of a pace, and our physiology is paying the price because the natural tranquilizers in the brain are suppressed and people experience more anxiety. Pastors get sick often right after Holy Week, right after Christmas and Advent. Why? Because you have even the wonderful time in ministry, but it's physiologically identical to the really bad time. There's something called eustress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, the good stress, has the same impact internally on our body, and it suppresses our immune system. We're more vulnerable to whatever cold or flu is going around that year, and we crash right after the holidays, right when we want to go on vacation, right, as pastors. And then we can have adrenaline fatigue, very common among pastors, often on Mondays. Anybody experience the Monday blues? Yeah? A little foggy-headed, lethargic on Monday, irritable, more than normal. What I think is going on is a post-adrenaline transient depression. Your body's trying to recover from cranking out all these stress hormones on Sunday just to meet the demands of the job for probably a 12, 14-hour day, and you're trying to recover. A lot of pastors take that Monday off. You need to take a day off. I encourage you to think about not taking Monday off, and here's my rationale. The church created all your stress so they can have you on your day when you're not 100%. I think that's a fair trade. Take a day off later in the week when you feel better and you can truly engage with the stuff that is life-giving to you and enjoy it. And try that for a couple months if you typically take Mondays off and see what kind of difference that makes. So in general, overall, for clergy and physical health, we have a higher rate of what's called metabolic syndrome than the general population of North America. It includes three of these five things, and you're diagnosed with metabolic syndrome: high blood pressure, high blood sugar, high bad cholesterol, which is the triglycerides, low good cholesterol, which is HDL, which is the higher risk factor for heart attack, and large waist circumference, meaning moving toward clinical obesity. I'll pick on my own denomination. It's a cousin. We might as well merge, Church of the Nazarene and the Wesleyan Church. If you go to a Nazarene convention like this, it's a metabolic syndrome convention. It just is. I'm concerned, especially if it's clergy. And I wonder if there's a hidden food addiction problem, honestly, among my dear, beloved brothers and sisters in the Nazarene Church. Why is this the case? Well, we think what's going on is chronically elevated stress hormones in the bodies of pastors and then not eating right, not exercising enough, and not sleeping enough. And you get metabolic syndrome. You also get depression and burnout. That's the other thing that's significant for clergy, depression. I say this because I want to normalize it for you. You have an inherently depressing role from a clinical perspective. I heard a psychiatrist describe being a pastor as a serotonin depleting environment. Isn't that interesting? It may surprise you, psychiatrists are actually quite familiar with clergy in their offices. There's something in the water of being a pastor or a priest that suppresses serotonin and other neurotransmitters involved in depression and also anxiety that can lead to depression symptoms. You're also immersed in other people's loss frequently. You're exposed to trauma frequently. Depending on your context, maybe as frequently as other first responders, police, firefighters, even combat zones if you're in an urban environment. And there's an impact to that. And so I want to normalize depression for you, because a lot of pastors will say something like this to themselves: I shouldn't be feeling depressed because I'm a pastor. So I'm a failure because I'm feeling this way. I'm going to beat myself up internally for being depressed. Well, what does that do to depression? This makes it worse. As opposed to saying to yourself what you would say to a parishioner: this is there to listen to understand and to seek help for. And so again, you've got a lot of resources at your disposal to connect you with wonderful Christian counselors who understand your world. And if I can be helpful to you in that way, or Dave's office can be helpful to you in that way, then I really want to encourage you to take advantage of that. So it's the physiological over-arousal over time that we have to kind of worry about, because the unpredictability of the job, the chronic interpersonal stress that's there, it's a sedentary lifestyle. And sometimes we can compartmentalize spirituality in a way to say, as long as I'm spiritually okay, whatever that means, it doesn't matter what's happening to my body or my emotions or my relationships, as if those aren't part of spiritual formation. You'll hear Pete Scazzaro and many others, including me, say otherwise, that the biblical picture is holistic. It involves all of who we are. And it's a stewardship kind of issue, I think, the way I think about it. We can also, most of us in helping professions, have a little streak of codependency in us. Are you all familiar with that term? Needing to be needed. It may have been ingrained in us on our own family of origin experience or other life experiences, and so we can overextend ourselves, and it looks very servant-like, and we get strokes for it. You know, oh, pastor, you do so much, you work so hard. And the parentheses there typically is, so keep doing what I need you to do for me, pastor, right? That's the subtext often of a comment like that. But it can lead us to overextend ourselves and then resent the church for it, when the truth is it's our lack of boundaries there that's creating that. And then we find ourselves depleted and exhausted. So how are you all doing? Well, could be better. But that's not uncommon for most any pastor in any denomination. General happiness, work engagement, work satisfaction are in a good range. And female pastors, again, seem to be more satisfied with their work. However, feel more overwhelmed at the same time. And I wonder if that's because of the role overload, in particular for women in our culture, especially if you're working full time. But there's also the expectation of being a homemaker, a wife, and mother, and all those expectations that come with that, that can be overwhelming. But there's some other areas I want to encourage you to think about. What can I do for myself and my Wesleyan brothers and sisters? Work stress. Well, let me start with life satisfaction. The life satisfaction there, I suspect, is tied to all the rest of these. That if things aren't going well in ministry, for pastors, things aren't going well in life. Those things are very connected. 27% of the sample reported a lot of ministry-related stress, meaning it's an excessively stressful season. Work-life dynamics are tough. How do I balance the demands of church life and family life and my own self-care? It's very challenging. The two biggest concerns I have for you are these two. Physical health. A lot of folks feeling like their health isn't good and they don't have a lot of physical energy. And then the financial strain and worry is significant. Both of those showed up in both the survey results as well as the open-ended qualitative questions as concerns. And you can see some of the statistics there. The one at the very bottom caught my eye. 66% cannot make it financially and ministry income alone. So either a bivocational or their spouse also has a job, and that's stressful. And so again, I just if you hear nothing else from this week, from my perspective, take advantage of the financial program that your denomination has created for you. If you haven't done that, that alone can go a long way to helping with this daily well-being kind of piece. And then some other things you need to think about. Cultivating Sabbath. You see, develop a niche activity there. That means have a hobby, play. Do something that takes your full attention, that you're good at, and that you have to really concentrate on. Why? Because then you take a mental break from work. Because what we do, and I do this myself and have to, you know, figure out ways of practicing what I preach. When we have a day off or time off, we're not really off up here, right? When are you done planning the sermon? When you say amen at the end of it, right? And even then, I've had a pastor tell me, well, then you go back and start thinking about what you wish you would have said differently. So it's always going to take a mental break and to detach from that in a healthy sense can be incredibly renewing. Eat, rest, and exercise. We just don't do enough of that as pastors. And sometimes we don't know how. And so we need help with all three of those. And so there is help for you for that. And be conscious of boundaries, and there are ways of consciously managing your adrenaline in helpful kinds of ways. Okay, I'll hurry and be done here. Resilience. This is about bouncing back, adapting, being able to kind of roll with the inevitable challenges that come in life. The things that hinder flourishing from pastors, there were many in this research. These were the top four. Complaints from parishioners. Anybody relate to that at all? Negative challenges from lay members. This means challenging your pastoral identity. So it's not just I'm complaining about something in church. I'm fundamentally saying you're not a good pastor in a global sense. And this is more often the case for women in ministry and pastors of color, we're finding. You shouldn't be a pastor because you're Hispanic or African American or because you're female. And so challenging at that fundamental level, it's not fun to be on the receiving end of that, especially if it's frequent. Churches that demand the pastor conform to their expectations. When I first read those three, I thought, well, that's just the job description of being a pastor, right? That's kind of every church. But this is talking about when that's excessive. And what I think is going on there, why do people do this to pastors? People will say things to pastors they'd never say to anybody else in their life. They will feel permission to level criticism. Most of that, at least 70% of that, has absolutely nothing to do with you. Not a thing. It's what we call, as psychologists, projections. Psychological transference. Transferring, consciously and unconsciously, thoughts, feelings, ways of relating from a person's past, even their childhood, unmet parental needs, disappointments in their own marriage with God, all kinds of things. The same way this projector is projecting onto the screen, your role is the screen. People are working through their stuff on you. You ever feel that? When you know it's not about you. Know, the downside of that is 70% of the compliments we receive have nothing to do with us either, so that's the bummer side of that. So how do you stay grounded in the sense of who you really are, your actual strengths and gifts, and your actual growth areas? You got to have somewhere to have supportive, realistic, accurate feedback, because you're swimming in this sea of other people's projections, and it's why it's isolating. So what do we do to be resilient and prevent burnout, which you're all familiar with? It involves these kinds of things. We think that somewhere around a third of pastors at any given time are in moderate to severe burnout. And most pastors move in and out of that at various points in their career. But here's the thing. Burnout sneaks up on us. Pastor after pastor has said to us, I was blindsided. I didn't see it coming. It hit me out of nowhere. Well, the truth is it had been building and moved through that mild and even moderate phase, and it hit a threshold of severity. And then all of a sudden, we're really aware of it right away. But by then, the cost can be high. Professionally, financially, relationally, which then begs some questions. How do we prevent it? How do you have people in your life that help you know the early warning signs, what those look like in you? Because your spouse will see it in you, Your close friends and colleagues will see it in you, maybe before you see it in yourself. And does somebody love you enough to point that out so you can take early action to prevent that? What we're finding is that these kinds of competencies, developing these intentionally prevents burnout. It's similar to emotional and social intelligence kinds of competencies, if you're familiar with those books. Self-awareness, what am I feeling? Self-reflection, why am I feeling that way? What's this triggering in me? And then self-control is, well, what then do I do with that awareness of what I'm feeling and why I'm feeling that way? It's the capacity to emotionally self-regulate. It takes an enormous amount of emotional self-regulation to be a pastor. I have this fantasy that every pastor should get one day a month when you can say whatever you want to say to whoever you want to say it to with no consequences. Wouldn't that be awesome? Just don't hold back, let it fly, use expletives. I mean, just go off, you know. You don't do that. And you don't do that for very pastoral, theological, important reasons. But what do you do with the residue of then what you're left holding emotionally? And it's processing that in helpful ways that is important. So this is the area that is lowest for Wesleyan pastors. In particular, pastors going through life and career transitions. Your burnout level is probably about what it is for most pastors, around 39% or so. Not feeling in control of work, doubting that I can really influence or change anything or influence my career. A sense of helplessness that sets in seems to be a significant issue for Wesleyan pastors. I thought this one was interesting in light of Pete Scazzaro. I'm an absolutely huge fan. You have to go to Pete's sessions and Jerry's sessions. It's just transformational material. I really love their stuff. 52% of Wesleyan pastors said that they attempt to make sense of a situation and decide what to do without relying on God at least some of the time. We had Pete come speak to a group of pastors out at APU, and a pastor essentially said something along those lines, and Pete in his very direct Italian New Yorker style said, "Your problem is you're a functional atheist. You have all this theology in your head, but what you actually do every day in ministry, you behave as if God didn't exist." And connecting our faith to what that looks like as we are in that practice of ministry, sometimes pastors forget to do. And self-control, having healthy habits. Now, most any American is probably going to say, to some extent, I struggle with this. And most pastors say this because we feel a call to have a disciplined life. But that can be challenging. And so there are some resources available to you that can help you with that. Accountability is one of the biggest things that can be helpful in that area, by the way. We know what we should do. I just re-upped my gym membership at my gym in Southern California. The guy that was signing me up told me that 80% of the people that buy a gym membership around New Year's time never come once to the gym. Isn't that fascinating? So they do all this marketing because they get all these memberships and then nobody actually comes. Because there isn't accountability. There isn't someone there helping you, coaching you. You have all the resources you need to do all the practices I'm talking about here available to you. You'll see a list when you get the PowerPoint of the kinds of things you can do to help yourself and these self-regulatory capacities to just develop self-awareness and to understand yourself and how you operate emotionally and relationally. And really encourage you to invest in intentionally developing conflict resolution skills if you haven't done that. Do you have to go looking for conflict as a pastor? It comes looking for you, doesn't it? Whether you want it or not. And it's just part of the deal. And some of us learned well from our family of origin how to cope with conflict, and some of us didn't. And to invest in learning those skills, how to be assertive, not aggressive, but also not passive. There's a middle place there that pastors find that can be enormously helpful. And all of that together is flourishing in ministry. This is the directions. If you haven't yet had a chance to fill out the feedback tool, then you can log on. You'll put in your email address, password that you make up, and the referral code Wesleyan, which tells our system that you're part of the Wesleyan Church. And then it'll take you from there. And you can also download the phone app from that website. It's all free. Starting in March, you'll be able to go back every 6 months and retake the feedback tool, and it'll start to build a dashboard for you over time of how are you doing in these areas over time. Hi, how are you? And I've gone a little long before questions, so maybe one question. Flourishing in ministry. Yep. And you'll see a button on the website called Map My Days. And it'll give you instructions on how to download the app. I'll hang around if you have questions. I'm sorry to keep you long. Yeah. Yes. Be around all day. Absolutely. Sure. My pleasure. I'll leave some cards up here too, and God bless you all. Thank you very much. Take care.